the next panel, the social science perspective on treatment and prevention, challenges and opportunities. And I invite Catherine Dodds and Marcia Rosengarten to join us. Catherine Dodds is a lecturer at Sigma Research in the Department of Social and Environmental Health Research at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And Marcia Rosengarten is a professor at Goldsmiths College, University of London, okay, with a special interest in science and technology studies.
Thank you very much. I just wanted to start off by saying that my talk today actually started through initiation with many co-authors. Just make sure this goes ahead. Mainly while attending the 2013 Conference of the Association for the Social Sciences and Humanities and HIV. So we very much welcome the opportunity that we've been given to extend that discussion with you today. What I will set out are the reasons why urgent support is needed for investigations that situate ARVs for prevention in its social contexts, further elaborating on several of today's talks, actually. And this will include attention to the global contexts within which this strategy of treatment as prevention or ARVs for prevention have been produced, and the local social contexts of implementation. It's helpful to think of a few of the sexual and reproductive health issues that have been met with technological solutions so far. For each of these, and there are many more examples, it might be worth taking some time to consider what the path to optimal implementation probably looked like from the outset, and think about contrasting that with how far we remain from that now. Often it is systems of social meanings that have molded the progress of each of those technologies, and which continue to do so. Some of those systems of meaning and social contexts will include moral judgments that are cast on the types of people who might need such protection, or how people feel about having these things inside of them, or systems of power, including the power to withhold information for fear of its misuse, as well as structures of hierarchy and privilege. For example, exclusive access to such technologies that's only for those who are deemed to be responsible enough or who can afford them. The social science research agenda that we propose interrogates ARVs for prevention to examine who is best and least served by implementation and why, on the basis of differential social positioning, access to resources, and the social organization of institutions. And so I want to begin from the center of how major advances in medical technologies are often initiated, evidence gained through randomized control trials. We need to acknowledge the RCT environment is one that produces evidence in a highly protected, highly resourced, cushioned, monitored, privileged environment, something like an infant swaddled in an incubator. Of course, the incubator is not a long-term solution for any infant, and once they emerge, that individual faces a whole new set of developmental challenges to ensure that it flourishes, including material resources and support and nurturing from people and from social systems, and from institutions. Now that this particular kind of evidence about ARVs for prevention has emerged from the incubator of the RCT, we get nowhere if we believe that somehow treatments implement themselves. It is essential now to be considering our understanding of those complex interactions between the ARVs for prevention themselves and community-level histories, and the impact of supportive social networks, as Anand Grover reminded us today, the importance of dignity, and institutional systems for drugs delivery, and resourcing, and political structures. There is considerable evidence already accruing about what is, and has for many years actually, already been happening with regard to ARVs for prevention in everyday experience. In PLOS Medicine in 2012, Wilson describes how even in high-income countries with enviable testing rates and clinical access among those in the most affected populations, these natural experiment grounds for ARVs for prevention are almost all falling well short of what was anticipated. Public Health England have estimated, for example, that among all people with HIV in the UK in 2011, 58% of them had an undetectable viral load. For the United States, that's reported at 25%. We've heard these figures several times through this conference. The common explanation for this is the now familiar notion of the treatment cascade, about which Gardner and Wilson and others have written eloquently, and I have a list of references that you'll be able to use if you pick up the slides online. What is often asserted in discussions about the cascade is that if health systems can improve their delivery at each of these points, driven in the first instance by massive increases in routinized periodic HIV testing, then the challenges to ARVs for prevention will be resolved. And yet, perceiving the cascade and what creates it as simply a clinical puzzle to be solved is considerably narrow-sighted, as Noyan and others have already pointed out. Of course, questions of affordability, geographic issues of access and improved accessibility of services are clear and have already been the source of much discussion here. But we cannot turn away from the other complex everyday issues, such as ongoing and increasing state-sponsored repression of men who have sex with men, of sex workers, of people who inject drugs, and undocumented migrants, and of shrinking budgets for the provision of social and practical support for those who need to be on medications for their own health and well-being. So this leads me on to my central purpose, which is to set out some of the key social research questions that are crucial to our understanding, not only of the treatment cascade, but the social context within which all HIV prevention efforts are positioned. At each point in the cascade, I will present a summary of the needs of individuals, systems, and structures, and this will be accompanied by an arrowed box which highlights the areas of social research, helping us to better understand and hopefully meet those very needs. In order to arrive for an HIV test, people need to feel that it is safe and worthwhile to do so. We therefore need to reinvigorate explorations of how HIV stigma maintains social inequalities through the oppression of women, racialized groups, men who have sex with men, and people who inject drugs or trade sex, and how all of that impacts on risk perception and service access. Without understanding that in local context, we can't get people to the start of a treatment cascade, let alone progress them through it. Alongside this, we need information on sexual and drug injecting practices, partnering patterns, gender relations, risk perception and management, as well as HIV knowledge and literacy across subpopulations and settings. Those features can change very quickly, as recent political, social, and economic events in Greece and in Russia, for example, radically change what it means to come forward for an HIV test. In 30 years into our epidemic, there are lessons to be learned from all of those social and political and historical contexts of HIV prevention, treatment, care, and support. So there's also considerable retrospective work to be done there. Being successfully linked into care requires safe and meaningful integration of information, referral processes, and high degrees of trust in the referral agencies. This requires local and global examinations of structural, commercial, governmental, and institutional determinants of service use. And further down into other elements of the cascade, we need to better understand ways in which social factors in hospitals and clinics, including social relations between staff, work to either attract or repel patients. And even further down, purchasing practices, treatment stockouts, and hierarchies throughout government, clinical and business infrastructures all need to be better understood, given how deeply they are implicated in the cascade. Enrollment and retention in care require service users who believe in their value and who are able to access them affordably and safely. It is essential for us to begin comparing what we know about the perceptions and experiences of service use and of ARVs across diverse priority groups. Accessing ARVs requires a supportive infrastructure, as well as users and providers who find ARVs for prevention acceptable and feasible. Young and McDade have recently reviewed the literature on user attitudes to ARVs for prevention, setting out what is already available and what further work is required. Furthermore, there's a growing body of work about attitudes towards ARVs for prevention among those who are expected to provide those services, both in the community and clinical healthcare providers. In posters 59 and in 15 upstairs, you can see further evidence on this. At a broader level, we need to maintain an evidence base which explores, critiques, evaluates, and supports all of this activity in order to ensure that what is implemented is worthwhile and sustainable. This requires comparative frameworks of formative and process evaluation, policy analysis, cost-benefits analyses, with clearly defined comparative sets of outcome measures, and some idea of what success looks like on parameters beyond simply HIV incidence. And as colleagues noted yesterday, there are continual improvements to be made in mathematical modelling and the social science assumptions that get built into those, and there's more work to be done in that area. And finally, social researchers have a role to play in identifying and testing pathways to implementation that are locally relevant, needs-driven, and ethically coherent. Just on to my last slide. In conclusion, I'd like to underline the different but mutually supportive roles in scientific inquiry of the physical and the social sciences. The Greek skeptics, such as Socrates, developed a system of learning through asking questions. The skeptics set out to examine how each new argument or piece of evidence suggested a new set of challenges and questions. Skepticism is a central method of obtaining knowledge through systematic doubt and continual testing, and this understanding of learning is at the center of the scientific method. Social sciences work alongside the physical sciences to develop those pathways of inquiry, using our different sources of expertise to push ahead. Skepticism does need to be delivered with respect for our mutual endeavor and needs to be received similarly. This is how, working in combination, we ensure that laboratory, clinical, and social sciences advance knowledge. Sometimes this approach does generate uncomfortable questions, such as, what has happened to the place of informed consent? What does the world of HIV prevention look like when our primary intervention is test and treat? And what would the political implications be if it became widely perceived that the health of the herd was more important than the needs of the individual? These questions are essential, as are many others. It is incumbent on all of us to ask them and answer such questions early and often. When we are in conversation in meetings like this, skepticism needs to be respectful and respected. It has value. Challenge and disagreement create opportunities to generate new understandings. So just in closing, I'd like to thank all of those who helped in the drafting of this talk. You can download the full text, the written text of this talk at this link here, and that also includes the list of further reading that I mentioned earlier. Thank you very much.
My slide has changed. I'd like to thank the organisers for inviting me to participate in this forum, and I'd especially like to thank Jane Anderson, who I think has been a really champion of the social sciences in HIV, and perhaps people aren't aware of that. She's supported numerous PhD students working in the social sciences, and for that I'm very grateful. I don't want to, and I don't think it's necessary to rehearse the value of the social sciences that's been set out so well by Catherine. And I certainly don't regard myself nearly as equipped as Myron Cohen, who's going to follow this session, for me to speak directly on treatment as prevention. So I'm going to offer something a little different. And I hope this contributes to how we might maximise all the wanted outcomes from treatment as prevention. And I'm not even going to dare to say what those wanted outcomes are, because I think there's quite a bit of difference here about that. I'm going to begin with an extract from and a commentary on science fiction to aid some conceptual rethinking of treatment as prevention that attends to what we know is a dynamic epidemic. Indeed, an epidemic in which humans and objects affect each other and change as a result. On the basis of this viewpoint, I'll briefly outline why an exploratory research approach, or what my colleagues call a speculative research approach, might be important at this stage. The science fiction story is called The Universe of Things by Gwyneth Jones. Aliens have colonized the planet, humans are no longer the superior or dominant beings, and as becomes apparent, this is at least in part due to the way the aliens' technologies are, quote, unlike ours, intrinsically alive. The aliens' tools are biological extrusions of themselves. They built things with bacteria. Bacteria which were themselves traceable to the aliens' own intestinal flora, infecting everything. In effect, as Stephen Shapiro, an American theorist based in literature studies, says of this tale, the aliens literalize Marshall McLuhan's thesis that all media are prosthetic extensions of ourselves. The aliens exteriorize themselves in every aspect of their environment. Their networks extend far beyond their own bodies and immediate surroundings. They are even able to share feelings and memories, as these are chemically encoded in the slime that they exclude and exchange with one another. In consequence, the aliens could not experience being apart. There were no parts in their continuum, no spaces, no dividing edges. They are alive in the midst of an entirely living world. Shaviro's next set of comments have caused me to wonder whether they may have some resonance here. He says, the living world of the aliens stands in sharp and bitter contrast to the way we remain trapped by our sad Cartesian legacy. We tend to dread our own mechanistic technologies even as we use them more and more. We cannot escape the pervasive sense, endemic to Western culture, that we are alone in our aliveness, trapped in a world of dead or merely passive matter. Our own machines remain things, and people remain lonely. Clearly, Shaviro is concerned with the way that we assume that objects are apart from us rather than with us. We do not think of our humanness as always already entangled with technologies in the multiple modes of our being. Yet, as he goes on to say, when we make use of things, employing them as tools, we are really allying ourselves with them. And alliance also means dependency. We discover we cannot do anything without our tools, without our tools' help. The story posits that vitality is shared by all things and not limited to ourselves alone. Shaviro's intention is not to make the case that we need to think of things as simply tools that have an effect on us and require management or skill. Instead, his interest lies in how their existence extends beyond, or in his terms, in excess of the particular ways that we grasp and comprehend them. It's not simply a matter of how we perceive them. Indeed, sometimes we don't even perceive them. We forget that their effectiveness is the result of a vast network of alliances, mediations, and relays, and may only become aware of this when a tool fails to function as expected. It's at this point that the excess of the object is revealed to us. The HIV field is, I want to suggest, especially rich with examples of how so-called prevention tools extend beyond us. With the early introduction of antiretrovirals, new modes of risk calculus emerged in gay sexual cultures. The condom altered, no longer necessarily the remarkable norm in anal intercourse, and an early version of treatment as prevention came about with undetectable viral loads combined with serosorting and strategic positioning, where a gay HIV-positive man would take the receptive position or be a bottom in the specific absence of a condom with a casual partner of unknown serostatus. What we can also deduce from this is that people on antiretrovirals demonstrated, not unlike pre-treatment days, considerable initiative when it came to negotiating risk. Importantly, for what I want to go on to say, to suggest, initiative does not simply reside in people. In the example of changing risk calculus, it's possible to recognise the dense entanglement of antiretrovirals, diagnostics, medical knowledges, and doctor-patient relations. The dense knotting paved the way for the Swiss statement and for HPTN052, research that now provides legitimacy to revised modes of risk calculus and sexual practice. It's also possible to reflect on how it is through antiretroviral failure that we have become critically aware of the various alliances, mediations, relays that are necessary to achieving adherence. Here I'm referring to not only dosing, but remembering to take pills, having access to them by remembering to get a prescription, in locations with limited infrastructure, having transport to get to them, and of course there's being tested in the first place. In other words, we have direct evidence within the history of the epidemic of what Shaviro refers to as the aliveness of things. It's this aliveness that brings us here and now poses the question of what do we do with them? How do we work with antiretroviral drugs, diagnostics, diagnostic results, sex, relationships, gender differentials, and huge disparities in provision within and between many national health systems? In the few minutes I've left, I want to just give some sense of how social science might approach this in collaboration with biomedical science and also what might seem like an unlikely partner, the discipline of speculative design. The aim, following what I've drawn from Shaviro, would be to study objects, here antiretrovirals, to give more insight in how they are not so distinct from us, and certainly our relationships with them are not fixed. By attending to their being with or becoming with those negotiating HIV risk on a very intimate level, new strategies may emerge for maximising antiretrovirals for treatment and prevention. In practice, this may take a slightly different tack to what we usually do or aim to achieve in terms of predictive outcomes. Gathering material may involve interviews, focus groups, but not for seeking quantification and generalisation. Rather, the intention is to seek out the unexpected, the peculiar, the troublesome, the incommensurable. It's these sorts of research outcomes that may allow us to reflect on and hence devise more inventive ways of intercepting the virus. As a rough sketch of what this might mean, we could, for instance, and this is very kind of early thinking on my part, we could, for instance, follow treatment as prevention as a novel object and see what aspects are enabling it to become normalised. For example, in social media and reports on sexual encounters online or in the clinic. Through processes by which treatment as prevention possibly becomes normalised to some extent, we might also learn of new initiatives by those negotiating risk that in themselves involve new conceptions of risk, risk practices, condoms, regular and casual relationships. And or we might follow treatment as prevention to see how it partakes in forms of discrimination, making life difficult for some in contrast to others. Elsewhere in my discipline of science and technology studies, one of the examples that's used to illustrate discrimination is the door closer or door groom that discriminates against elderly people. With TASP, with treatment as prevention, we already know that partners in a serodiscordant relationship may differ in their feelings about treatment as prevention. One partner may think it's safe to not use condoms, whereas the other doesn't. Indeed, here we might consider that treatment as prevention discriminates against condoms, while also noting that condoms have more often than not discriminated against women by excluding them from determining protection. And as Gus Cairns, I think, valuably made us aware today, also discriminate against receptive men. To quickly sum up, I'm suggesting that we think of the game-changing possibilities of treatment as prevention, not on what we already know, but in the spirit of real interdisciplinarity, enter into the aliveness of things in their relations with one another in order to enlist what each society and each experience might be capable of. Thank you.
I believe we might have time for one or two questions. Sorry, Julio.
Hi, I'm Anna Forbes from the United States. I wanted to thank you both for very provocative talks. I wanted to ask you, Catherine, specifically, it seems to me that we have seen a great deal of variation in the level of investment in social science components of RTCs. The MDP-301 trial on tenofovir gel, for example, while it didn't show the product as being successful, did include enough social science research to teach us a great deal about how the product was being used and how it was not being used and what you had referred to as the unexpected. I wondered if you could talk, perhaps both of you could talk a little bit about how you see the information that we are able to catch through random controlled trials being useful in the implementation process, whether you see a connection between the level of investment in social science research in trials as having an application to how the implementation process rolls out and the ultimately relative success of the product or not.
My background isn't in being involved in the social science that's within the trials, but I have some limited awareness of that, and I agree with your point very strongly, Anna, that different trials seem to have very differing, not only, I think, levels of investment, but levels of actual engagement. And I've seen that coming through in a number of papers at other conferences where it's certainly possible to see the extent to which the design of the trial has allowed social science to exist within it, but hasn't necessarily enabled it to flourish. Or hasn't been very necessarily supportive of that. So I think part of what I'm trying to say is that within RCTs and outside of RCTs, the place of social science is crucial. And I don't think that we should be seeking to diminish or prejudge the learning we can gain from that valuable evidence, depending on where it's come from. But we do have to really critically analyze the conditions within which those social science research questions were developed. And I think that's quite a helpful differentiation to make. That probably hasn't fully answered your question, but I hope it helps a bit.
Useful.
I think that there's an immense amount that we could learn while randomized control trials are going on that we don't. And I don't know whether there will be more that will come out about FemPrep, for example. I mean, mainly I followed PrEP. But it would seem the most important thing to know from FemPrep now is why did the women not take the pill and why did they say they were taking the pill? And that's why I think it's kind of would be great to be able to do more exploratory research where people don't feel that they have to tell the truth, but can just actually feel that they can tell us more about what it's like to be part of a trial and so on. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Well, if there are no other questions, thank you very much, and we'll move to the next plenary.